tuned in to the Community Cats podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Hello, this is Kristen, the podcast technical tabby. Not to worry, this episode is going to contain plenty of our stellar host, Stacey LeBaron. She has, of course, been involved helping cats for over 20 years with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. But I'm here to let you know this is part one of a special podcast. It's an audio version of a masterclass held late last year for community cat enthusiasts with Brian Cordes and Susie Richmond. They are, of course, friends of the show and the resident experts at Neighborhood Cats. And this webinar was called Colony Caretaking Tips and Tricks. You're going to get tons of helpful ideas to help you perfect the way that you care for your free-roaming cats. This week, they are going to cover all your cat breakfast, lunch, and dinner concerns. So that's how to establish feeding patterns, keeping wildlife and pests away from their food, and what to feed without breaking the bank. Plus, there are hints and how-tos so you can build feeding stations where cats will be comfortable and not competitive when they're having dinner. There's even a cute story about Brian's first colony and the challenges that came along with feeding those kitties. If you want to check out the recording of this with all of the visuals, which are fabulous, Brian takes great pictures, I set up a handy link for you guys. It's communitycatspodcast.com/everythingTNR, and that will take you right to our Everything TNR playlist where we've collected the full versions of all of the free webinars presented by Neighborhood Cats. With that, I'll remind you that the goal of this podcast is to turn your passion for cats into action. I hope you find lots of tips to help you do that and you enjoy this episode. And I can't wait for you guys to come back next week for part two. It is equally as fantastic.
So we have two presenters today. So we have Susie Richmond, who's in the background helping with answering questions. And you may see her on a video or two over the course of our many events. She is the executive director of Neighborhood Cats, having served in the role since 2010. She oversees hands-on TNR programs in New York City, Jersey City, and on the island of Maui, as well as using her prior Madison Avenue advertising experience to write, among other things, crowdfunding appeals to help the many sick and injured cats who come to Neighborhood Cats way. One of her favorite projects currently is a veterinary scholarship program designed to train community cat-oriented vets on high-volume spay-neuter techniques. And when she's not in the office, you can find Susie out in the fields of Maui, where she recently passed the 100,000 cats trapped mark. And Susie and Brian both have had to prioritize, and they are in Maui working in the burn zone quite a bit. So much of their work is focused in that area and has been for the last several months. And we have Brian Cordes, who serves as the Neighborhood Cats National Program Director and Susie Richmond's husband. Back in 1999, while working in Manhattan as both an attorney and a video director, Brian co-founded Neighborhood Cats after TNRing a colony near where he lived. Except for a six-year stint as a grants manager for PetSmart Charities, he has been with the organization ever since. He's authored or co-authored handbooks on grassroots TNR, community TNR, and return to field programs. And you can always find him online, where he regularly presents both basic and advanced webinars on all things trap, neuter, return in partnership with the Community Cats podcast. All right. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Brian.
Okay. Thank you so much, Stacey. And thanks everybody for taking time out to learn more about how to care for our community cats. So let's get into colony caretaking and what that involves. And of course, I think the first thing to recognize when we talk about being a caretaker is that the bond between you and the cats is primarily focused around food. Not that there aren't other aspects of it that can be just as strong, but initially and then throughout the time that you're caring for the colony, food is going to form the central part of your relationship. Community cats are not wild animals in the sense that they subsist on their own. In the United States, there are some who you can find like in the forests of Kauai in Hawaii, for example, or maybe some other wilderness areas where the cats are living, you know, strictly by predation. But in the United States anyway, the vast 99.999% of these cats are not living by predation alone, and they have a link to some type of human-based food source. So whether it's a feeder who comes by every day or a dumpster behind the supermarket, whatever it might be, there's a link to humans. And that reliance on us for food is what ends up forming the bond for them. So we're going to spend a fair amount of time, the first half of this webinar, talking about food and feeding and all the different aspects of it. And then we'll have a break, and then we'll come back and talk about other aspects of caretaking as well. Let's get into feeding. And the first thing to understand in terms of really optimizing your work as a caretaker is that you're much better off if the cats have a feeding pattern. And that means the cats are feeding as close as possible to the same time, same place on a daily basis. And keep in mind, like I'm sure most of you have pet cats, they're very habitual creatures. So if they're used to eating at, 7 a.m. every morning, good luck sleeping in late, right? Because they're not going to let you. They want their food when they're used to getting it. And outdoor cats are exactly the same. So it's not hard to get them on a pattern. If you feed them at 8:30 a.m. every morning, they're going to learn within a week or two that that's when the food appears. And especially if the food doesn't stay out all day, they'll be even more motivated to show up at that time. And this has all sorts of advantages in terms of trapping. For example, if you have newcomers, you're going to know where they're going to be and when they're going to be there. It has implications for managing wildlife, not attracting rodents, things like that. So if you can't do it at the exact same time every day, then try to keep it to a section of the day. So always feed them in the morning, or always feed them at dusk, or always feed them when you get home, or as close to that. Any kind of pattern is better than no pattern. And you don't want to leave food out 24/7, because then it's completely random when they come, and it can be very difficult to monitor them and to trap them if you need to. Also, try to develop a sound that they associate with you when you come to feed. And often the cats do that on their own. Like, they can distinguish the sound of different car engines. So we've seen this repeatedly, like where we drive up to a location and see nothing. And then 5 minutes later, the caretaker shows up in her pickup truck and the cats come running out because they recognize the sound and they recognize the visuals as well. So, get a clicker or do a special whistle or jingle your keys or shake your jar of crunchies, whatever it might be. Get them to associate a sound. And this will help you also to, if you need to trap, because if they're being at all hesitant, you can use that sound to draw them out. So feeding patterns, real super important. So what you want to avoid is attracting wildlife. If you're in an area where there is some, and that's almost everywhere, you could be in the middle of Manhattan and attracting raccoons. So in order to do that, and that can cause a lot of issues, right, with people not saying, you're feeding the cats and I've got raccoons in my backyard or coyotes or whatever it might be. So if you feed during daylight, most wildlife is nocturnal, and you can avoid most wildlife issues if you feed during the day. So you would set your pattern up for daylight. Now, on the other hand, if you're dealing with birds, like here in Hawaii, there are feral chickens all over the place and very few mammals and none that would compete with the cats except for maybe mongoose. But birds and mongoose are diurnal, meaning they only come out in the daytime. They go to sleep as soon as it gets dark. So most caretakers around here, their cats after dusk. And that way they avoid attracting wildlife. And again, the same idea, don't leave food out at all times. And keep the feeding area clean, even if it's not your garbage, clean it up so that there isn't food left out for wildlife to find. Now, sometimes you get into situations where maybe raccoons or wildlife are out during the day, or for whatever reason, you can't establish a feeding pattern or whatever it might be. Here's one very clever way to feed your cats and not feed the raccoons or the opossum or the skunks. And it's called a raccoon-proof feeder. And you can see in this slide here, the plans are from Forgotten Felines of Foresight. If you click on that link, it should take you to them. It's obviously pretty simple construction, but basically it's a platform that is raised up a few feet off the ground, and the platform has a metal flashing around it. So it's impossible for an animal to climb up the pole and then grab onto the platform and pull themselves up. But meanwhile, the cats can jump that high, get up onto the platform, which in this photo has a little covered feeding area to protect it from rain and things like that. You'll also notice on the right, on the ground, there's what's called a little jumping station. And that, you know, gives the cats a little bit of an extra boost. Maybe you've got some seniors and they can't jump quite as high as the younger cats. So giving them a little place to jump up from will help them get up. So raccoons and those types of animals, they can jump, but they can't jump up. They can jump across. So this will solve that problem for you. That's one kind of pretty clever way to avoid those issues. So what if you have wildlife that comes at night and you have birds who come during? Well, the way we have found to solve that problem is what we call bird-proof feeding stations. And it's really quite simple, as you can see in this photo. The birds, they're not really afraid of the cats. So they'll walk right into a feeding station, even if they know there are cats around. But they don't like to go through these plastic strips. So if you take some heavy-duty plastic, like maybe 3 millimeters thick, and you can get a drop cloth at your local hardware store, you know, cut off a piece of it, use duct tape to attach it to the front of your feeding station over the doorway, and cut it in strips. So the cats have no problem with this. They just rush right through it. But the birds, most birds will not pass through these plastic strips. It's not 100%, but we have found that it's most times it's pretty successful. Another thing to do that we found, like we're feeding hundreds of cats in the Maui burn zone, and there's a ton of chickens all over the place now. They've repopulated. Well, we find if there's a large concentration of the chickens, if we just give them some food like cracked corn, stuff that the cats wouldn't eat, they're satisfied and they tend to leave the feeding stations alone. Okay, so let's talk about what kind of food to feed, because we're often asked that, you know, for our recommendations. And first, before we get into that kind of guidance, it's kind of important to know, to be able to evaluate the nutritional quality of a food. Now, that there are pet food experts out there who know far, far more than I do. And there are books you can read, and you can really educate yourself about this a lot. But if you're looking for just some very basic guidelines, what you want to do is, the first thing you want to do is look at the ingredients label, like you see on the back of this can. This was a brand called PetGuard, which I don't think is in, unfortunately, is not in production anymore. But the ingredients label will list the ingredients in the order of their volume. So when you look at this ingredient label, you see that beef broth, chicken liver, kidney, those are the largest amount. They're the largest percentage of the ingredients. That's a good thing, because cats are carnivores and they need meat. So if you look at the ingredients label and the first thing you see is cornmeal or some type of grain, well, that's not going to be as nutritious as a food that has meat as the primary ingredient. So that's a basic guideline there. Now, it's, you know, the more meat there is and the better the quality of the food, the more expensive it is. So there's that to take into account too. You do get what you pay for. That's just the reality. There are some good values, and we'll talk about those in general. If you want something like organic meat and you want the meat to be, you know, there to be no grains at all and just very, very high quality, that's going to definitely be a lot costlier than your supermarket brands, which may have more grains or things called meat byproducts. So a meat byproduct, for example, might be the feathers from a chicken, right? Doesn't mean it's the actual meat. So whole meat is your best ingredient. Another thing to take into consideration when we're talking about nutrition is the whole wet versus dry kind of, I don't want to say debate, but there's dry cat food and then there's wet cat food. And so the first thing I do when I talk about this is I'm vegan, so this slide is hard for me, but it illustrates the point really well. So on your left, you've got a nice juicy steak, right? And on your right, you have that same piece of meat baked to a crisp. So if you were eating for yourself, which one do you think would be more nutritious? So obviously, the meat that is not baked to the point where it's solid is going to be healthier for you, right? Now, it gets trickier too with cat food because you have a lot of added, because the meat is not complete in itself. There's a lot of amino acids and vitamins and things like that that are added to the meat. Now, your cheaper dry foods add all these ingredients before the baking process. As a result, a lot of them are destroyed, right? Your more expensive and higher quality brands of cat food will add these ingredients after the baking process, which is a more laborious and complicated process. Hence, the price is somewhat higher. Now, sometimes people wonder about, well, you know, is a higher quality of dry food better than a lower quality of wet food? That gets really complicated. And this idea that the canned food is healthier than the dry food really only applies when you're talking about the same brand. So if you can get Purina canned food versus Purina dry food, the canned food's going to be healthier. But whether Purina wet food is better than Blue Buffalo dry food, that's a whole different question, which is you need to kind of really know your stuff to answer that. And I don't know it well enough. So that just takes more research. So when you take all this into account, you know, cost and ingredients and wet versus dry, what we advise caretakers to do is choose the best quality and type of food that you can comfortably afford. So that takes two very important things into account. One is that idea that nutrition matters. So the healthier the food that the cats get, the healthier they're going to be. On the other hand, your budget and your wallet also are just as important. And we don't want, you know, people going out there, you know, spending their whole Social Security check, the highest quality canned food, and then leaving nothing for themselves and struggling financially. That's not, in the end, going to be very good for the cats if you're not in a good place yourself. And then how many cats are you feeding, right? Are you feeding three cats in your backyard and you can comfortably afford top quality canned food? Then feed that. On the other hand, if you're feeding 30 cats a night and your income is limited and, you know, really you're relying on large bags of dry food, because they're more of a value, then that's fine too. There's no judgment here. You have to take both the nutritional value of the food and the importance of your financial stability into account. So that said, on the dry food side, there are some really good value brands out there that are relatively low cost. They're not the cheapest, but they're not relatively expensive. They're relatively, you know, good price. And you can get them in large bags. And so they're a good value financially, and they provide pretty good nutrition. And here's three that we're aware of. The Kirkland Signature is the Costco store brand. So if you don't have a Costco card, very good reason to get one. So you can get access to these. I think they're 20 or 25 pound bags. They're very reasonably priced. Rachel Ray Nutrish, natural chicken and brown rice, is surprisingly affordable. And then Diamond Naturals is also a great dry food that is more in the, oh, I think it's about $1.50 a pound range when you buy the big bags, which is pretty good. Okay, so where do you feed your cats? There's a few tips, you know, guidelines that we've kind of developed over the years. One is that we believe that low visibility is best. That discretion is in the cat's interests. So if you can feed the cats in the backyard instead of the front yard, we would advise you to do that. And I would also point out, like, if you look at this photo, this is the very first colony that I worked on. And we're talking, well, I won't say how many years ago, but a very long time ago. These cats are not with us anymore. And what happened was, We used to feed in a backyard of one of the businesses on the block, and we were so enthusiastic that we were always there in the back, you know, walking through the business. It was ironically a pest control company, and basically the workers got sick of us after about a year and they kicked us out. Then we had to feed in an empty lot in that same square block, we had to, we didn't have access. It was this empty lot. We didn't have access to it. So we had to feed through a fence, through one of these old wrought iron fences. So the food was protected from people. They couldn't get into the lot, but everybody could see it. So every year for the next 3-4 years, we'd have 1, 2, 3 abandoned cats at that location. The property owner finally came to trust us and gave us a key. And the first thing I did is what you see here, was I put the food in the water behind a whole bunch of big rocks so nobody could see it, and never had an abandoned cat after that. So that's just a word of warning about making your feeding more visible than it needs to be.
Have you ever wished your cat could talk to you? Well, get ready for an event that will help you better understand your feline friend's needs, thoughts, and feelings by observing their behavior. Join us on April 20th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. for the Community Cats Podcast Annual Online Behavior Day. It's a full day packed with invaluable insights and expertise from our dream team of feline behaviorists, all focused on unraveling the mysteries of cat behavior. Dive into workshops covering a range of feline behavior concerns, from enrichment strategies and kitten training to tackling preventable behavior issues that can often lead to surrender and managing harmony in a multi-cat household. We'll even discuss pet safety. Alongside fascinating workshops, we're spicing things up with fun cat trivia and exciting prizes to keep you engaged and entertained throughout the day. Plus, you'll have a chance to network with fellow professionals and volunteers in the animal welfare sphere, sharing experiences and strategies to better the lives of our kitty companions. So whether you're a seasoned rescuer, a passionate volunteer, or simply a cat enthusiast eager to better understand your kitty, mark your calendars for April 20th and join us for an unforgettable day dedicated to understanding and improving feline behavior. Get all the details and register online today at communitycatspodcast.com/behaviorday. That's communitycatspodcast.com/behaviorday.
Ready for a grant challenge like no other? Mark your calendars for the Inclusive 2024 Open Arms Challenge. For the entire month of April 2024, animal shelters, foster-based organizations, and public charities are encouraged to create a new program or expand an existing one focused on keeping pets and people together. Learn more about how to register and important dates at maddiesfund.org. Are you passionate about spay-neuter? Do you want to create more low-cost opportunities for spay-neuter in your hometown? If this sounds like you, then there's a brand new podcast you'll definitely want to check out. Tune in to United We Spay, a monthly podcast from our friends at United Spay Alliance, hosted by me, Stacey LeBaron. Each episode delves into the heart of the spay-neuter movement, addressing root causes of overpopulation and empowering communities for a brighter future. On United We Spay, we answer tough questions, shift the conversation from symptoms to prevention, and champion solutions for limited access to affordable spay-neuter services. United We Spay is your go-to source for making a difference, spreading knowledge, and elevating the conversation around the importance of spay-neuter. Available now wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to like and subscribe so you never miss an episode.
You also want to feed in a way where you're having a minimal impact on neighbors or a work site. You want it to be safe and quiet. Remember, it needs to be accessible for you. You may find just the absolute best spot, but you know, if you have to scale a 6-foot wall and go through a narrow alleyway and all that to get to it, maybe you should find something a little more convenient. And if you're in an area where there's wildlife, especially if it's considered threatened in any way, you want to avoid that and feed as far away from there as possible. Avoid, this is a common mistake that caretakers often make, which is they put the food right on the ground, like you see here. So the problem with that is if they don't eat it all, it stays there. And somebody's going to come along and eat it, and it may be a rat or it may be wildlife. And it's certainly going to cause you problems with neighbors, because nobody likes to walk outside and see a big bag of dry food dumped on the driveway, or you know, canned food surrounded, you know, with a swarm of flies around it sitting there rotting on the sidewalk. So don't just dump it on the ground. Always put the food on something that you can then pick up and take away. So it could be, you know, paper plates, you know, plastic, whatever it might be. Now, of course, there's one other aspect to this, which is you got to pick up the plates. You got to take them away. So we deal with feeders right now. And when we come upon the feeding site, what we see, paper plates and little bowls, and they're scattered all over the place, which is great for the cats. They didn't have to eat the food off the ground. But it's not, it's rather understandable why the local residents are starting to get very angry at the cat people, because they're making a total mess. So use plates and stuff like that. But if you have that feeding pattern and the cats are showing up at 5 p.m., they'll be done eating by 5:30 or circle back later and pick up the garbage. That is the number one complaint against people who feed cats. And believe me, I'm not accusing everybody of doing this. I think most people are conscientious, but have a look at this slide. You can see not everybody is. And often people who are tolerant of the cats, not particularly cat lovers, they end up not wanting them around, not because of the cats themselves, but because of the people and the people not showing respect for the neighborhood. And the number one way people are disrespectful when they are is by leaving all this garbage behind them. So pick everything up, including the non-cat trash. Like, an area is clean or it's not clean. And when people come along, they're not going to say, the feeder didn't leave that bag of garbage. They're just going to think the place is a mess. So when we clean up a site, we just pick up everything and be a good neighbor. And actually, that will help you with neighbors. Don't leave bags of trash on site with any food inside them, because you could end up harming the wildlife when they rip that bag open and try to get to the food. So what about feeding stations? Always recommend them whenever they're possible. Obviously, they're not always possible. But if you can build a little structure that the cats, where the food is kept in and water is kept inside of it, has a number of advantages. One is that it keeps everything neat and clean. It can also allow the cats to protect the food and the cats eating during inclement weather. And you can keep your supplies, like dishes and things like that, maybe some, talk about little vaults, but things you can store food in that can't be accessible to animals. Gives you a place just to keep everything. Now, the key thing to understand about feeding stations is they're not shelters. So you're not trying to keep the cats warm. You're trying to protect the food. So you need to have a large opening for the cats to go in, like you see in this plywood feeding station in this slide. And the reason for that is if you have just like one small doorway, like you would have in a winter shelter, Mr. Top of the Ladder Tomcat can go in there and easily keep everybody out and decide he likes hanging out in there. So in order to prevent that, you either need to have one large opening in the front or at least two smaller doorways on either side so cats can go in and out and not end up being territorial about the whole thing. As I say, in this slide, you're seeing a pretty simple winter shelter that's made out of plywood, but there's all sorts of creative things that you can do. As you see on the upper left, you can take a 30-gallon trash can, put it on its side, maybe put a couple of cinder blocks next to it so it doesn't roll away, and boom, you have an instant great feeding station. You can also take storage bins. 55-gallon is great. We often are, like now, we in the burn zone, we use 30-gallon ones, so the cats can't get in there, but they can stick their heads in, which is good enough, when you're in a temperate climate. If you're in a kind of more inclement climate, then you probably want these bigger storage bins so they can go all the way in. But basically, you're taking these storage bins and you're getting a box cutter and you're tracing the opening of the door in the front. And you just take your box cutter and just keep tracing it and pushing down lightly. And within, 5 to 10 minutes, you'll have sliced all the way through and you'll have an instant feeding station, which is easy to keep clean because the lid, you got the lid you can take on and off. One tip, put something heavy on the lid so it doesn't blow away, like a rock or a couple of bricks or something like that. Now, and then on your lower left, you see the smaller feeding station. So that will have a doorway on both short ends, but it's also very simple and inexpensive. If you want to go the fancier route, you can actually go to a website and a company called Ferrovia, and they have prefabricated feeding stations that they ship to you and you screw them together. And they're very high quality. And as you can see, they even have shingle roofs. So you can go that route if you want. There's also, for those of you who really want to get sophisticated and hide your feeding stations, there are what are called mock rocks. And that's what you see depicted here. That's a fake boulder. It's hollow inside. It's made of some type of resin poly material, which you can buy one of these and then, you know, get a jigsaw and cut a doorway so that they can, and then obviously keep the food and the water inside there. So that's your gold standard. Now, they're not cheap. The bigger they are, the costlier they are. But, you know, it might be worth a one-time investment, or you can go onto YouTube. There's 103 different videos about how to make a faux rock cover and just do it yourself for quite a bit less cost. So gravity feeders are can be another very useful device. And you see one here. And a couple of things about that. Really, it's like, you know, I've been emphasizing, it's better not to leave food out all the time. You don't have a feeding pattern. You're potentially attracting other animals. But there are situations where you can't feed on a regular basis. Maybe there you have limited access to the facility. So like this particular cat lives in a jail, on the grounds of a jail. So yeah, they weren't going to let us just kind of come marching in every day at 5 o'clock and feeding the cats. So we needed to use a gravity feeder and have food available on a regular basis. Now, if you don't need to use a gravity feeder, then obviously don't. It's also possible that maybe you're going to go away for 3 or 4 days or for a week. God forbid you actually take a vacation, and you can safely leave a gravity feeder somewhere and know that your cats will have access to food during the period you're gone. That can be a real legitimate use of them as well. And they have automatic waterers too. Now, one tip about this is only use the smallest ones that you need. So these automatic waterers and feeders, they come in, you know, multiple sizes from 1 gallon to 10. Don't get a 10-gallon automatic waterer because then you're going to have to 10 gallons of water to change it. So if you only need 1 gallon or 2 gallons, use that. And the same with the dry food, although that's not as critical an issue because the food typically doesn't go bad. It's the water that is hard to keep changing. So it's not a bad idea to have more than one so that you can swap them out because they can get pretty dirty and they do need to be cleaned, especially the automatic waterers can start to get algae, especially if they're in the sun at all. So rather than spending time on the site, scrubbing them and cleaning them, obviously a lot easier if you can just swap it out with a clean feeder or waterer. Usually it's the waterers that are the problem, and take the dirty one home and clean it. But you know, that may be a luxury that you can't afford. So a few other tips when it comes to feeding, just some tricks we've kind of learned over the years. If you don't have a feeding station and it's going to rain, what do you do if you want to make sure the cats get their foods, at least for that day? So one of the things you can do is what you see in this photo on the left, which is your typical takeout dish, right? And fill it with dry food and take the lid, turn it upside down and put it on top. So that will effectively keep the rain out of the food. But when the cats come out later after the rain stops, they can easily just push the lid off and have access to the food. I mentioned Vittles Vault. That's the product you see in the middle. If you want to keep dry food stored on site, this is what you want to use because it contains the scent of the food as well as the food itself. It's impossible for an animal to open that on its own. And then the arm extender is real good for if you're feeding through fences or difficult to access spots. So when we were feeding through the fence at that original colony, we would take our arm extender and push the food back from the fence so it was out of anybody's arm's reach. Okay, feeding in the wintertime, the cats actually need more food in the wintertime because they need to move around more in order to stay warm. So there's been some research on this and it shows that on average, cats need about 15% more food in the wintertime than they do in warmer weather. So the problem for those of you who live in colder climates is that you have to rely more on dry food, right? Because if the cats are right there and you can give them wet food, then go ahead and do that whenever you have that opportunity. But if you can't do that, then you have to use dry food because the wet food will freeze So cats always need access to water, but when you're relying on dry food, it's even more important because they're not getting moisture from the food. So how do you solve that problem? Well, there's a number of ways to stop or slow water from freezing. And here's a few. We've got more on our website at neighborhoodcats.org. If you look under how to TNR colony caretaking section, you'll see a page on stop freezing water. But these are some of the highlights. There's the device called the solar sipper, which absorbs sunlight and then uses that to heat the water, and it will stop it from freezing down to about 20 degrees. You can get an electric heated water bowl and never have any water freezing. You need to get a large water bowl and fill it all the way because the water will evaporate over time. So it needs to be filled every day and filled to the top. There's devices called Snuggle Safe where you can put them in the microwave for a good 10 minutes or so and then put them under the water dish. And that will be a heat source for at least a few hours. Those are products you can purchase. If you want to go the do-it-yourself, here are some tricks for you. So the deeper and wider the water bowl is, the longer it will take for the water to freeze. So there's an example of just one. So you can see it's a thick plastic, so it's good insulation, it's deep, it's wide. You can also take your water bowl and put it inside a styrofoam cooler, like one of those little picnic coolers that you can buy for, you know, several dollars in the summertime. Just make sure you get it in the summertime because it won't be available in the winter. And you just take a steak knife and cut a doorway in one of the short sides and stick your water bowl inside there. And that, again, it will slow the freezing process because the styrofoam will insulate, keep it the temperature warmer longer. Same thing that you see on the right of the slide. Those are little vaccine boxes. So they're pretty small. And what you can do is line the interior with a plastic, with a, you know, a thick, you know, it could be a garbage bag, a trash bag, you know, a small container, like your kitchen wastebasket, something like that. And put that in there, cut a round hole just a few inches wide, maybe 3 inches, 2 to 3 inches wide, through the top of the box. And then big enough so that the cats can kind of stick their face in and their tongue down and reach the water. And that too will insulate the water and dramatically slow down the time it takes for the water to freeze. If you're dealing with a lot of snow and you need to clear a path for the cats, you want to, you know, well, you can use a shovel like Jade was doing in this slide. Sometimes people want to just, you know, use some type of solution to just kind of melt a path. You don't want to use rock salt or any type of chemical de-icers because they can be toxic and highly irritating to a cat's paws and things like that. So if you want a safe solution, use what's on the formula that's written on the slide here, which is Dawn dish detergent mixed with rubbing alcohol on warm water. And that will melt the snow away and the ice away and not be harmful to the cats. What about insects? What about ants in the food? That's a common complaint. So the trick is that ants can't swim. So you create a moat. The ants can't cross in order to get to the food bowl. So here's one example of building a moat, which is getting a cookie sheet pan, and just putting a bit of water on the bottom and then taking your food bowl and putting it right in the middle. So very easy for the cats to get to the food, but impossible for the ants to get there. Now, if you need a smaller setup, you can do this, which is what we call a pan and a pan moat. So you take two pans that are the exact same size. One of them on the left, you're filling with, you know, an inch of water at the bottom. And then you take a couple of little small plastic bowls and fill them with water too. And the bowl should be more centered than the one is on the bottom left there. You don't want them touching the walls of the pan because that would give the ants a pathway that didn't involve going through the water. So you then take the other pan, fill it with food, and put it in the pan with the little bowls in it. So it's raised up it's not touching the other pan. It's raised up by those little bowls. And there's no way for the ants to get to the dry food. So the advantage to I know I'm getting awfully esoteric here, but this is what we deal with every day now in Lahaina. The disadvantage to this, what we've learned is that as the cats eat, they may drop bits of food in the water. And 24 hours later, that smells really bad. So if you do it this way, food does not get into the moat water and it just stays a lot cleaner. So what about flies? You have to work around them. And so you don't want to leave wet food sitting out on a hot summer day because then you're going to get swarmed with flies. So if you're feeding wet food and it's not being eaten right away, only put it out maybe at dusk or early in the morning when it's cooler. They're not unattracted to dry food, but they're a lot less attracted. Probably the best way to deal with flies is they sleep at night. So if your cats are eating at sundown, at least during the summertime, you'll avoid issues with flies. And for those of you, for the cat caretakers who have everything, you might want to get them this as a Christmas present. And it's a wireless auto feeder. So it's this one particular brand, which you can get at that link, has a couple of nice things. It's raised off the ground, so that's very nice. But kind of the techie part of it is you can program it with your smartphone when to dispense meals. So you can fill the thing up and you can, you know, set the meals to come out, I think up to 10, maybe at least 10 meals that will automatically be dispensed. So if you're feeling lazy one day and you don't want to make the walk over to the colony site, you can just pick up your phone and tell it to feed the cats now. What about slugs? They can be a problem too. There's a few ways to work around that. My favorite one is just leave a little dry food on the side. You know, the slugs, if the food is right there on the ground, and we're talking just a few pieces of dry food potentially, the slugs will just go to that. You know, they're actually not stupid. And if they can eat food that's right there on the ground, they're going to do that rather than kind of slime their way up the bowl and into the food. So just put a little bit, tiny bit on the side for them. That's not working for you. Then you can use what's called diatomaceous earth and create like a circle around the food bowl with it. So diatomaceous earth is actually these microscopic shellfish it's not the shellfish, it's their shells. And it feels like a fine powder, like a baby powder or something like that. But on a microscopic level, they're quite jagged and sharp. So slugs or other insects will not walk across it because it will injure them. So if you create a little circle around your feeding area with diatomaceous earth, it won't hurt the cats at all, but it will keep the insects away. You can do the same thing with crushed eggshells or chalk powder, same idea, that to your hand, it may feel smooth, but to a slug's, it's going to feel very sharp. A sheet of sandpaper, if you put the food bowl on a big sheet of sandpaper, same thing. The slugs and creatures like that will not want to go over it. Now, when you're using diatomaceous earth, and we'll speak about it again later when it comes to fleas and things like that, it's super important to understand there are two kinds of it. There's what's called food grade, and there's pool grade, P-O-O-L. The food grade is what you want. That is not harmful. If a cat ingests it, it will not hurt them. In fact, some farmers use diatomaceous earth food grade and they feed it to their cows and in order to kill the parasites inside the cow's, you know, digestive system. So it's extremely mild. However, keep in mind that it's actually just millions of tiny little sharp objects. So you do not want to inhale it. If you inhale a lot of diatomaceous earth, you could seriously damage your lungs. So wear a dust mask if you're spreading it around and it's getting in the air, or very carefully spread it so that it's not dissipating in an aerosol kind of way.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.